Just a brief introduction to myself and why I'm standing up here talking about environmentalism and whether it's a religion or not. My scientific background is I was trained in applied science, majored in medical physics, spent most of my career in computer speech and language modeling, so I know a bit about mathematical modeling of complex systems. But I guess 15 or so years ago, I turned into a businessman, started a speech recognition company, and since the late 90s have been involved in starting a number of other businesses, including some mission initiatives as well. My interest in this subject really started probably in 2006, when pretty much like most of us, I tended to take at face value what people were popularly saying about our environment. But being a scientist, I got intrigued and decided to do a little bit of digging. And what started as an interest in writing a very brief overview paper, particularly about climate change, ended up being a four-part book, which is yet to be published. But I spent several months, actually, when I had the opportunity on a sabbatical researching and writing. So what I want to do this afternoon in an hour and a half, or less than that, including time for you to disagree or ask questions, I really want to try and distill the thesis of that 300-odd page book into about an hour. So I'm going to ask if you will forgive the brevity of some of the matters that I will discuss. By necessity, I'm going to have to be quite brief. My job here, I think, really is, in the words of John Lennox a couple of ELFs ago, where he said in one of his workshops that our job, particularly in respect to dealing with atheism and people like Dawkins, he said something that stuck in my mind. He said, our job is not to win the argument, but to raise the right questions. So what I hope I will do this afternoon is, at the very least, raise some questions in your mind for you to go away and perhaps research a bit more yourself and think a little bit more about the whole issue that I want to discuss this afternoon. I want to look at this question, is environmentalism a religion, through the lens of climate change? As you know, that there are many, many aspects to the environment and to concerns that people have about our environment, but the one that tends to hit the news and to be very prominent in people's minds, and of course is a very politically hot potato, as we call it, is climate change. And you're all well aware of the many protests that take place around the world, typically with banners like Save Our Planet, and lots of provocative statements. And our media bombards us with the spectacle of polar bears sitting as here on an iceberg about to fall off, or indeed jumping off. Or, of course, the very tragic events that have happened over the last few years of tsunamis, flooding, and extreme weather events, as they're called. And, of course, there is a direct connection made by the media in people's minds with climate change, and, as we shall discover, the whole issue of what is causing climate change. The religious dimension of this, I think, really came into my mind when reading the former Chancellor under Margaret Thatcher's government in the UK, Lord Lawson, who wrote in The Spectator in 2006, these words: it is, I suspect, no accident that it is in Europe that climate change absolutism has found the most fertile soil. For it is Europe that has become the most secular society in the world, where the traditional religions have the weakest popular hold. Yet, people still feel the need for the comfort and higher values that religion can provide. And it is the quasi-religion of green alarmism and what has been termed global salvationism, of which the climate change issue is the most striking example, but by no means the only one, which has filled the vacuum with reasoned questioning of its mantras regarded as a form of blasphemy. What I want to do really is to unpack that challenge and to help us to answer that question. Is he right? Do we have any grounds for thinking that environmentalism has this religious dimension to it? One of the reasons that it's important for us as Christians, I think, to address this issue is that Christians, evangelical Christians, are quite deeply divided on the whole issue. A recent poll done by the Pew Forum in the US really looked at different demographics in the US to look at where people stood on the question, is there solid evidence that the Earth is warming? And you can see that overall, 48% of the US population answered yes. Right down here with the category which they call white evangelical Protestants, the number was 34% believed that there was solid evidence, 31% definitely believed that there wasn't, and then we had 17% saying, yes, there is evidence, but it's natural patterns of change of the climate. So I think what that shows us, in quite stark contrast, is that Christians, even evangelical Christians, are divided. There's evidence for that, of course, as you read some of the published books, as you look at some of the blogs that are on the internet from both sides of the debate. The Evangelical Climate Initiative in the US basically takes up the mantra, now is the time for followers of Christ to help solve the global warming crisis. And they cite on their website three claims. Human-induced climate change is real. So now not only do we have climate change, but we have what is called anthropogenic global warming, or an attribution of humans being the cause of that. Claim two, the consequences of climate change will be significant and will hit the poor the hardest. Here, obviously, we appeal to our compassion and our emotions. Third, which is probably the most controversial, as you'll see as we unfold the talk this afternoon, Christian moral convictions demand our response to the climate change problem. So I would argue that we really, as Christians, cannot ignore engaging with this issue and being very clear in our own minds where we stand on it, and then actually what should we do, if anything, about the issue. A couple more quotes here from Christian writers. Climate change is real, serious, and potentially apocalyptic, written by Spencer and White in 2007 in their book Climate Change and Sustainable Living. Berry has argued in his book When Enough is Enough that climate change and its ramifying consequences are now accepted by all but a few die-hard refuseniks. This is an evangelical actually speaking about our attitude to climate change. So Christians should care, because actually it's an issue that's causing division, so therefore we need to think carefully about it and where we stand. I want to argue, as you'll see, I hope by the end of the talk, that there are some epistemological reasons why we should be concerned about this. The issue of what is truth? How do we know what truth is? How can we discover it? But thirdly and importantly, and I don't want you to go away with the feeling here that Christians therefore should be interested in the climate or can turn their backs upon it. Christians do, as we'll see at the end when we look at the theological implications, we do have a responsibility to care for creation and also to do righteousness and to do justice. So I want to look at this question of is environmentalism a religion under four topics or four different perspectives. First, the science. Secondly, some philosophical issues that you may or may not be aware of. Third, the political ramifications. And finally, and fourthly, to just sum up with what I would like to present to you is some theological perspectives and principles that we might use as Christians in looking at our response, whatever that might be, to the whole issue of the environment. So let's move on and to think about the science first of all. Now, of course, the science is settled. Or is it? Herein lies, I think, the area of biggest disagreement and the whole contentiousness of this whole issue of climate and is it changing, and if so, what is causing it? So let's ask ourselves the question, what do we know? And let's leave aside the philosophical question of how do we know what we know, but confine ourselves to thinking about facts, evidence, data. What do we know? Well, I would argue that, and I haven't really met anybody, to be honest, who disagrees with this, that the climate changes. It always has. So what's the problem? What's the issue? Why am I standing up talking about this? Well, the issue, I think, is a subtle change in semantics. You may well remember that in the mid 2005, 2006, most of the media talked about global warming or even anthropogenic global warming. And then we came to 2007, 2008, and I think around the time of the IPCC's fourth assessment report. And suddenly global warming rather disappeared off of the scene, at least as far as the media representation of climate change was concerned. And what they substituted was the term climate change. But it's like there's a subtext now. Whenever a politician or somebody in the media talks about climate change, the subtext is, of course, anthropogenic global warming. So anything to do with climate change is, of course, all down to us. And therefore we must do something about it. So I want to just back up from that, and we need to ask ourselves the question, is it changing now? How do we know that the climate is changing now? And then crucially, what is causing our climate to change? And then if we can answer any of those questions, can we do anything about it? Is it realistic to do anything about it? What should our response be? Now, the whole basis for the thesis that our climate is changing and it's man's fault is the International Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC as it's usually referred to. It's an intergovernmental panel. And it is always pointed to in the media and by politicians as the authoritative source for what we know about climate. And in Chapter 9 of their fourth assessment report on Working Group 1, which really deals with the science behind climate change, we have this significant statement, which is now, of course, the statement that occurs in all of the policy documents. Human actions are, quotes, very likely the cause of global warming, meaning a 90% or greater probability. What they claim in their reports is that land temperature has increased by around 0.6 of a degree globally over the last 100 years. And if you look at the data and you draw a line through that, then yes, that measurement is supported. I would just point out, though, that in this data, what you see on the graph here is actually the monthly variations in temperature plotted each year over time. And it is, I think, very interesting to note the huge swings in temperature, seasonal temperature, that occur. But that's another point. Well and good. So again, you might ask yourself, so what's the issue? Well, the issue really begins with, what is a global temperature anyway, and how significant is it? And actually, is that the best thing to tell us what climate is doing and how it impacts our lives at a local level? The temperature data, which has been the subject of much controversy in recent years with ClimateGate, if any of you heard about it, the leak of a couple of thousand emails from the University of East Anglia. It's all about data that is collected. The red spots here on the globe actually show you the places where temperature data has been collected over some period of time. And you'll notice the heavy concentration in the northern hemisphere, very little in the southern hemisphere, and next to nothing across the oceans. But the oceans are represented. Now, one of the first problems here is what's called the urban heat island effect. And that is a known, measured and observed fact that some of the measuring stations have had buildings and goodness knows what put up around them. And various, here's just two examples. I'm sorry you can't see this very well with the sun coming in, but there's two examples here showing actual temperature plots over time. And you can see here the gradual increase over time of temperature here taken from this particular site in Marysville. This one here is in Orland, California. And you can see here this is really quite built up with exhaust fans quite near the temperature measurement equipment. Further, more detailed studies have been done in the US in particular, actually showing that per density of population in the county, temperature has clearly risen in comparison with lower populated areas over time. And here's a plot of the minimum temperature trends over the last 100 years in North America. The red parts show the increase and the blue actually showing a decrease. So what you actually can see is that temperature plotted in detail at a local level is highly variable. Some is increasing, some show a decrease. However, it can be said that if you take probably the most accurate temperature measurement that we have in the world, taken from the Amar Observatory in Ireland, where there has been no urban heat island effect. The temperature records have been kept there since 1796, so that's the longest and probably the most accurate temperature record that we have anywhere in the world. And if you plot a line through the mean, there is a slight increase in temperature over that whole period. Again, notice the seasonal trends in temperature, mean temperature, over that period of time. But of course, any of you who are scientists will know that you can show all sorts of things depending on where you start your data point and where you end. And if you take just a snapshot of from 1880 up to 2005, you could quite readily show some decreases and two increases in temperature trends. So we do need to be extremely careful when we're thinking about trends and what they actually represent. Some have suggested that satellite measurements are much better, they're much more reliable, and satellite temperature measurements have been made since the late 70s. Via various satellites. This is just actually one of them. And you can see here two plots for the South Pole and the North Pole, the North being the most variable and the one that actually shows an increase in temperature, whereas actually on this plot you can actually see for the South Pole a slight fall overall in the temperature trend over that period since the late 70s. So supposing we accepted that all of the debate aside about are these temperature measurements real? Is temperature the best way of measuring what's happening to our climate? Sticking with temperature, let's ask the question, are these changes new? And to answer that question, people have turned to temperature proxies, that is, ways in which we can try to reconstruct the past temperature trends in our world. And various ways have been proposed for doing this: ice core measurements, tree ring widths, pollen, stalagmites, bristle cones, etc. Here's a temperature reconstruction using oxygen 18 measurements as a proxy for temperature. And going back 3,000 years, you can actually see they've got the Roman warm period, the Roman cold period, Little Ice Age plotted up there, in the medieval warm period. So what you can clearly see there, if we believe those reconstructions and how they're done, what we can certainly see is a lot of variability and some upward trends and some downward trends. The problem with all of this is that in the third assessment report that was put out by the IPCC, which caused most of the alarm and gave rise to the terms unprecedented warming taking place in our world, was this famous but now discredited hockey stick graph that was produced by Mann and his co-authors. And it was a very controversial paper. It got through peer review, but was subsequently heavily criticized in terms of the statistical techniques that were actually used, the fact that it only looked at the northern hemisphere, which we know is the area of the globe that is being impacted the most, or is showing the most temperature increase. And in fact, probably the most serious accusation would be that the tree ring data were compared to temperature derived from another region. So really it was very poor science to actually produce a graph in that way. McKittrick and McIntyre re-plotted the data with the correct form of analysis, and that's the graph there that they produced, which is much less alarmist than the hockey stick curve that got popularized some years ago. Ice core proxies, one of the areas that we'll turn back to in a moment, plotting going back thousands of years to look at the temperature of the Earth using ratios of isotopes. And you can see here the big swings in temperature trends upward and downward. Okay, so temperature, if that's a valid means of looking at what's happening to our climate, does change. But what causes temperature to rise? Here again, we have big areas of disagreement and controversy. The IPCC blame most of the rise on greenhouse gases, and in particular the elevation of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. How do they justify this? Well, they focus on the carbon cycle, which you can see from this diagram is a highly complex system with lots of feedbacks and lots of variables. And what you can see is that carbon dioxide is given off through natural processes. It's given off through also through burning fossil fuels, but it is also reabsorbed back into the Earth system, and in particular into the oceans, which act as a huge sink, both giving off and absorbing carbon dioxide. Why is that important? It's important because the temperature of our world is actually quite wonderfully maintained. If you look at what's called the Earth's energy balance, that is that we receive incoming solar radiation and various things happen to that as it passes through clouds, as it gets reflected back off of the ice or absorbed into what we call black bodies. The important point here is not to get bogged down in the detail of this graph, but to realize that, yes, carbon dioxide does have some impact, as indeed does water vapor, which is a far more significant component of the atmosphere. What does carbon dioxide do? It absorbs infrared radiation. Interestingly, another point of contention is that there is a logarithmic relationship between temperature and the energy absorption, and some are arguing that in fact the carbon dioxide is, we're at a saturated, almost reaching a saturated level. Another point of contention. However, the IPCC have now in their science reports proposed the contribution that different greenhouse gases actually make to the Earth's energy balance, and it's basically reported in watts per square meter, energy that is either input or energy that is output, if you like, into our system. Again, in their report, they state the level of confidence that we have in the understanding of the science underneath these assumptions of how much does carbon dioxide or methane actually contribute to the climate that we live in. I think another very interesting point here is that 2% change in clouds during a solar cycle actually could vary the heat input to the Earth by an average of 1.2 watts per square meter, and this is compared to the carbon dioxide of 1.66. So carbon dioxide, nobody disputes the fact, has an impact, or the levels of carbon dioxide will have an impact on the Earth's energy balance, as indeed with the levels of methane, or indeed the amount of water vapor that there is in the atmosphere. Another contentious area is, so how much of that carbon dioxide that's up there was contributed by us? If you believe the IPCC that calculates rather than measures from their carbon cycle model, they claim that 21% of the carbon dioxide in the air, in the atmosphere, is actually contributed by man. People who've actually measured this using radioisotope measurements claim it's only 4%. So who's right? Who do you want to believe? Those that have measured it or those that use models to try to produce what they think is the contribution? Depending on then what you believe, the issue is, so how much does the temperature increase per unit of forcing, if you like, radiative forcing? Experimental work has actually shown a much lower figure than the textbook method of doing the calculation. And even if you take the IPCC's figures of radiative forcing, what you actually end up with for a doubling of carbon dioxide in the air, only a 0.37 degree increase in the temperature. Now, that's kind of interesting because they're saying that over the last 100 years, the temperature has gone up by 0.6 of a degree. So even if we start using experimental evidence, we find that the temperature actually has not increased as much as it ought to have done. Even taking the textbook calculations, we find it's less than that which is being stated at the moment. It's a complicated area, and of course I think what I'm trying to demonstrate is that there are so many variables, so many issues involved in trying to determine what is going on and what contributes to what are the feedback mechanisms, how well do we understand the actual underlying science, that it becomes rather difficult to be as positive, in my view, as the IPCC when they claim a 90% certainty of man being the cause of our climate problems. I'm going to skip on because time is going. I think for me, probably one of the most fundamental issues that has arisen, and this chart here is the chart that appears on Al Gore's famous movie, and it is the temperature trends and the CO2 trends, carbon dioxide trends, taken through measurements with the Vostok ice cores. And significantly, what it shows is that carbon dioxide increases follow temperature increases rather than actually being the drivers. So if you take all of that data and smooth it a little bit to see, you know, the detail of what's going on, to look at the trends, here you can actually see rather more clearly that what happens is by something like 800 to 1,000 years, carbon dioxide actually follows an increase in temperature. Now, of course, the proponents of anthropogenic global warming come up with all sorts of interesting explanations for why this should be the case. As a relatively simple-minded scientist, I kind of don't get it myself. It seems to me that this is, you know, cause and effect. It's very hard to start waving your arms and demonstrating that carbon dioxide acts as an amplifier, which is one of the claims that's made. I just don't see it in the actual data. I find it very hard to see how you could try to prove that hypothesis. There are, however, a number of other hypotheses for what might be causing change in our climate. Quickly skim over some of these. Cosmic ray influence, which has been proposed by Chaviv. His contention is that we know, nobody disagrees, that the level of cloud cover probably has a much more significant impact on our climate than greenhouse gases, other greenhouse gases would. And he has actually demonstrated a relationship. He's doing more work at CERN. I don't know how far he's actually on with that research at the moment to try to prove his hypothesis. Cloud formation and cosmic ray correlation is something that he has plotted and shows a very interesting correlation between those two. He's also done a reconstruction of cosmic ray flux versus geological temperature. That's past temperatures that have been obtained from proxy data. And that, again, shows some very interesting correlations. Others propose that there is a very significant impact of our oceans and what is called thermohaline circulation. That is cold water and moving around through the oceans deep down and warm water on top. You can see the currents here plotted on the map. And that has an impact, a big impact, on regional climates. There is what's called the El Nino Southern Oscillation, which is a relatively rare occurrence, but is one which has, again, the plots here show some interesting correlations between these oscillations and temperature trends. There are a number of other things that other scientists are actually arguing. So to sum up, the hypothesis that the IPCC put forward with some degree of certainty is that human CO2 emissions since the Industrial Revolution have caused a significant 0.6 degree rise in global temperatures. I would argue that this remains to be proven. But the cause and effect hypothesis has been falsified by the proxy data for CO2. Now, I accept that there are still contentions of over how accurate the measurements are for CO2 and for temperature trends, but if we take them at face value in terms of trends, it seems to me very hard to argue that CO2 is the prime driver. Experimental evidence suggests that the amount of CO2 residing in the atmosphere, that only a tiny fraction of that actually comes from fossil fuel burning. That's a point of contention. That's experimental evidence versus their carbon cycle models. We need to move on. The second hypothesis that the IPCC put forward is that further emissions will cause further dangerous increases in temperature that will destabilize the planet. However, I'd have to say that all the temperature forecasts that are being used are based upon computer models. And I know enough about computer modeling to know that I certainly wouldn't want to rely upon these, I don't really want to call them unreliable computer models, but maybe I should. They're no doubt very sophisticated, but the point is, if you start off by building a model to prove your point, you end up in a circular argument. And therefore, I think these computer models are of limited value in terms of trying to help us assess what the planet may or may not do in terms of its climate. I want to move on now to the philosophy aspect of this whole issue of is environmentalism a religion? And I think it's here that we'll begin to see maybe some answers to that question. Basically, one of the big things that has influenced the debate upon climate change is what is called post-normal science. And it's something that was proposed by Ravetz and Funtowicz in their rainbow diagram, basically where they set out to say that where there are areas of uncertainty in the science, might be about mad cow disease, it might be about the climate, but where there are huge social impacts, then basically we need to move into the area of post-normal science, which means that we need now other people, other than scientists, to contribute to the debate and the opinion forming in terms of what to do. Now that seems not unreasonable, perhaps. Mike Hume, who was director of the unit in East Anglia and is still based there now as professor of climate change at the University of East Anglia, said this: "The danger of normal science is that it assumes science can first find out truth, then speak truth to power, and that truth-based policy will then follow." I'm going to skip over Richard Feynman's argument, but to go on, Richard Feynman was basically arguing in his famous Caltech talk about the need for integrity in science. Now, when you read another statement by Mike Hume, you sort of think, well, okay, he's actually demonstrating this basic integrity, because he says deploying the machinery of scientific method allows us to filter out hypotheses. Well, that seems a reasonable thing to say, such as those presented by Singer and Avery. Actually, this is somebody who disagrees with his view on climate change, as being plain wrong, without actually saying why they're plain wrong. So you start off the statement feeling there's some hope that he's going to use the norms of scientific methodology. But there are two other characteristics, he goes on to say, of science that are also important when it comes to deploying its knowledge for the benefit of public policy and society. That scientific knowledge is always provisional knowledge, and it can be modified through its interaction with society. That, I think, is a very crucial and important statement as we think about this whole issue of, is environmentalism a religion, or if not a religion, a worldview? I'm going to skip over this, just a little bit background upon the methodology of science. I can probably tease that out in these slides here. Post-normal science, the way I think it works in practice, particularly thinking about the issue of climate change, is that if we start with the scientific method of making observations, we collect data. Then maybe we form an hypothesis. What does this data mean? What does it tell us? We then get into the area of interpretation of that data, and the scientific method really should require us to hypothesize and then test the hypothesis, and essentially to keep iterating around that process until we have a hypothesis that stands the test, and then we can elevate to the level of a theory. The problem actually with modern science today is that our own presuppositions impinge on our interpretation of the data, of the type of hypotheses that we come up with, and if we have a lack of rigor in iterating around those hypotheses and testing them, and of course some hypotheses I would argue are untestable. So they then get elevated to a theory without any testing at all. But in the case of climate change, there's a lot of science, a lot of data out there, but I would suggest that there are a lot of presuppositions and opinions, and this contribution of others, shall we say, other than the scientific community, impinges upon the interpretation. And if you start basically with the premise that carbon dioxide is the problem and human emissions of carbon dioxide are the problem, and then you seek to prove that hypothesis, it's not that difficult to do. If you ignore alternatives, if you ignore falsification and other evidence. The problem that we have is that then once this hypothesis, or not even a hypothesis, but perhaps just observations get presented into the public arena, disseminated by the media. Once that data becomes politicized, for whatever reasons, I mean, Margaret Thatcher was one of the instigators, Prime Minister in the UK years back, of this whole research into climate change, because she was, if you remember the stories of the coal strikes that we had, the coal miners, she was worried about our dependence upon coal. So you can find perhaps even politicians who have a vested interest in trying to prove the point. So you get this vicious circle of the politics then pick up on the opinions, the tentative hypothesis even, and what happens is that this then gets further disseminated and through the media, and the overall impact is the science is settled. It's a fact. The globe, the climate is warming, and we're the problem, and we've got to reduce CO2 emissions, and you know, what's the issue, guys? You must be a bit gone upstairs if you are not accepting that hypothesis. Now, all of this has familiar rings to it, doesn't it, for those of us in Christian circles where we disagree on certain points of doctrine, and we can become very contentious where we try to defend our corner. And I would suggest that in the whole climate change debate, it has become virtually impossible now for alternative hypotheses to enter this belief system. Why? Because the peer review process is in the hands of a relatively small number of people who are all believers. And indeed, if you look at some of the ClimateGate emails, there's quite obvious suggestions there that people would like, if they could, to manipulate who are on review boards or editorial boards of some of the journals. Now, the IPCC will put out this whole idea that there is a consensus, an overwhelming consensus are the words that are used by 2,500 scientific expert reviewers. I don't have time to go all the way through this slide. I want to just pick out one point that I think is of interest here. Chapter 9 of the Working Group 1 Fourth Assessment Report, in which this statement, human actions are very likely the cause of global warming, meaning a 90% or greater probability, had 62 reviewers, of which only 5 explicitly endorsed the chapter. Only 7 of the total number appeared to be independent, and 34 actually had vested interests. They were either authors of some of the papers or had other vested interests. I've already talked about the bias of the pre-review process. Any of you who followed the news about the politics of climate and ClimateGate in particular, I'm not going to read all of these extracts from emails, and I think some of them have been overplayed. They're private emails, after all, and we all say all sorts of different things to each other in private emails. But what I think comes out from a study of some of those emails is much more the attitude of some of the researchers and contributors to the IPCC report, their attitude towards those who have alternative hypotheses or who disagree with them. And this whole issue of endorsement statement here, I'm very strongly in favour of as wide and a rapid distribution as possible for endorsements. I think the only thing that counts is numbers. The media is going to say 1,000 scientists signed or 1,500 signed. No one is going to check whether it's 600 with PhDs or 2,000 without. I think it just gives you a flavour of the sorts of comments. There are a number of comments rather like this that are quite illuminating. And various journalists have commented on them. Interesting one from New York Times. These researchers, some of the most prominent climate experts in Britain and America, seem so focused on winning the public relations war that they exaggerate their certitude and ultimately undermine their own cause. Let's move on quickly. Interesting statement there from Michael Mann about the vested interests. Hundreds of scientists work in this field, and we're a competitive bunch. We compete for scarce research dollars, academic recognition, and professional standing. And, of course, it's almost like a machine, because now if you want research funding for anything to do with climate, you've got to have basically the right belief system. Interestingly, the political pressure. Anders Fogh, I don't know whether I pronounced that right, Danish Prime Minister, somebody from Denmark might pronounce it correctly for me, at the Copenhagen Climate Conference said this, just an abbreviation, science should be the basis for decision-making in this field. Well, that's encouraging, you think. But he goes on to say, but not to provide us with too many moving targets and not too many considerations on uncertainty and risk and things like that. Well, any of you who are scientists here, and I know some of you are, that's an impossible task. That's why we have the impingement of so-called post-normal science, where people are now imposing their opinions on their interpretation of data. And that opinion has become the fact rather than any hypothesis which is really robustly proven or not. Janet Daly commenting in the Daily Telegraph in 2007 about the whole attitude towards climate change said this, "Perhaps I'm sceptical about the climate change campaign because its exponents remind me so much of the people I knew years ago on the Marxist left, repressive, self-righteous, and inherently totalitarian. Because of what they see as the indubitable rightness and the absolute moral transcendence of their cause, they can justify demonizing anyone who criticizes or dissents from it. Back then, the comrades used to shame those of us who blanched at their ideological ruthlessness with the epithet wishy-washy liberal. the exploitation of the working classes was the all-encompassing evil that had to be fought with whatever weapon it took. These days, you are castigated for worrying about self-indulgent luxuries such as free speech and open debate when we are all about to fry or drown, depending on where you happen to be on the stricken planet when the apocalypse occurs. A very pithy observation. So we come back to Lord Lawson's quote and ask ourselves the question, does he have some justification for suggesting to us that environmentalism is, quotes on, a religion? I want to move on to look at some of the policy consequences of the current worldview and belief in man being the main cause of the change in our climate. And these, I think, for Christians, again, are issues that we need to be cognizant of and careful about. Carbon trading is the one area that I want to just quickly focus upon. I don't know how many of you understand how carbon trading works, but essentially it's fairly straightforward. The government sells or gives, and a huge number of these credits have been given, gives to the emitters. You can't see the smoking chimney stacks here, but representing those who are putting out CO2 into the atmosphere. And they set a cap on your emissions. If you want to increase or go over that cap, then you must buy or trade your carbon credits. One of the ways that you can do that is to actually enter the clean development mechanism, the CDM as it's called. And basically what you can do is to offset your increase in emissions by putting up a wind turbine in China or a solar panel in Africa. Now the problem with all of this is that there are now several exchanges that are allowing people to actually trade these carbon credits. And the trade is astronomic in terms of size, expected to grow to 1.2 trillion in 2020. I'm going to skip over this. Carbon trading or carbon credit fraud has been uncovered. And Europol state that this fraud has caused more than 5 billion euros of damage for the European taxpayer. And it's estimated that in some countries up to 90% of the whole market volume was caused by fraudulent activities. So there's a huge opportunity here for people to exploit a pretty unregulated market. So is carbon trading a good thing? I think clearly evidence shows that it can be exploited. I think also there's a lot of research being done on it to see what impact it's really making. And here we actually show a slide of the emissions reductions that will be achieved by 2012 in terms of tons of CO2. By these clean development mechanism. And what you can see is actually these are in thousands of tons. You can actually see that the amounts are pretty insignificant compared to the emissions per year, depending on who you believe, whether the actual measurements or the actual carbon cycle estimates. You can see that the impact on reductions is pretty minimal, if not insignificant. That's not to say that maybe some of the CDMs are worthwhile. The problem is when you start thinking about the impact on developing countries, the scale is nowhere near big enough to make the sort of impact that developing countries need. What developing countries need more than anything is cheap electricity. That's not going to be provided by a few solar panels here and there or a few wind turbines. So the issue I would suggest then for us as Christians to think about is not is the Earth climate changing, but rather what do we need to do about it, if anything. So causation is fundamental if we are to think rationally and properly about what our response as Christians should be. Clearly, if we are demonstrably and unequivocally the reason behind this change, then maybe it is right that we should seek to do something to impact climate change. But I think the problem is that because there is so much uncertainty and indeed so much evidence that suggests that there are other things at play, that the trillions of dollars through Kyoto and the mechanisms that have resulted from that, in my view, I would suggest are going totally in the wrong place. We still have poverty. We still have flooding taking place in many parts of the world, where actually that amount of money, or maybe a fraction of it, could actually be used to deal with some of the impacts of the climate that we have, whether it's changing or not, actually the impacts of climate, just like the Dutch did something about their flooding many years ago. Could not also other things be done to deal with the impacts of flooding in Bangladesh, as an example? I'm going to move on to the last section, so I do want to give you an opportunity to ask questions or comments. So, from a Christian perspective, how should we, whatever we believe, if you actually think otherwise, that the data does demonstrate that we are causing a problem, or if you're sceptical about it, but you are concerned about the environment, what are the theological principles that should be behind our thinking? Well, I've lost the primary principle. Disappeared off the slide. It's to do with our creation purpose. So our care. The implication is that our care of creation should not be motivated by a sentimental preserving of what God has made. And this is basically, the principle is, why did God actually create the universe in which we live? We can see from the scriptures, Colossians 1:16, for example, that by him and all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him. For what purpose? And for him. The second point that comes out of that principle is that the universe will actually be remade. There's a lot of sentimentality that gets talked about the environment and what we should do with the environment and our impact on it. And I think it does. It's helpful for us as Christians to have the right context here in thinking about our universe. Of course, if you're not a Christian, your assumption is this is all we have, this is all our children will have and our children's children and forever. I'm not saying this is an excuse to neglect creation, by the way. I'm just saying it's something that we need to be sober-minded in our thinking about when we write or talk to others. I have seen quite a lot of rather sentimental statements made, even by Christians, about why we should care for creation that don't seem to me to be grounded well theologically. There's many verses through the scriptures from Revelation going backwards as to what God's purposes are for creation and what will happen. And I think sufficient evidence in the scriptures to say that the universe will actually be remade, not just tweaked about a little bit. I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. Behold, I am making all things new. The day of the Lord will come like a thief, and then the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the heavenly bodies will be burned up and dissolved, and the earth and all the works that are done on it will be exposed. There are, of course, various views on what some of those precise scriptures actually mean, but I think there's enough evidence in scripture to say that God will be remaking this universe. Some other verses here from Job and then the Psalms. But not only will it be remade, I think this verse here in Corinthians 2:9 suggests to us that it will be also a different new creation that God is about. It is written, "What no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the heart of man imagined, what God has prepared for those who love him." So it's almost suggesting to us that we can't really get our head around exactly what God's new creation will be like, other than what we know is that it was made for his glory. And one way that you can think about the universe and our place in the universe is, in fact, it is almost a stage on which God is bringing together his people, drawing together the redeemed, who will be those who will worship and adore him. God is immanent. The universe is upheld by him and was from the beginning. And the point here is that his general providence is seen in the constancy that we can describe in the language of science and mathematics. This is something that's perhaps relevant for us when we think about how do we interpret data, particularly those of you who are scientists. How do we think about that data and the hypotheses and the models that are developed to explain that data? How does that fit into what we know of God, his immanence, and the fact that he is actually upholding the universe? Is it not reasonable to, if you go back in climate history, to say this is God at work in the upholding of his universe? God is unchanging. The whole issue of speaking the truth, I think it's key for us. This is the epistemological question, if you like, that if, as Christians, we want to be sure that what we are promoting is grounded on truth, we must be very careful what argumentation we latch onto, as the Evangelical Alliance does on the climate, where this moral impact we have a moral requirement, if you like, to do something about our environment. What is that based on? Is it based upon truth, or is it based upon opinion, or is it based, in fact, as I have hypothesized, on an alternate belief system, a worldview that many around our world are holding? Another principle that we need to hold carefully in tension here is that we were to have dominion over the earth. Now, that doesn't mean that we can ruthlessly exploit the world in which we live, which some do, some industrialists do. What it means is responsible stewardship, and this stewardship of God's creation is primarily for human benefit. Here's the text in Genesis that speaks about that dominion. Interestingly, the Hebrew there can also mean to crumble off, tread down, or prevail against, which has a kind of interesting connotation to it when we think about what stewardship, what dominion means, when we actually do live in a world that has some harshness to it, and there is sometimes a need to subdue nature for the benefit of humankind. I think a very important and key principle that we must hold to as Christians is that we are to love our neighbour and to act justly. How does that work itself out in the whole climate change debate? I think it means that we must take care to work out for ourselves where resources should be placed. Are we actually placing resources and setting up mechanisms such as carbon trading which are detrimental to this objective of helping developing nations, helping those who are in poverty? As someone who actually works 3 months or so a year in Kenya, we have a project out there, I see firsthand, right up close and personal, the impact of poverty and the impact of their lack of resources and their need for cheaper electricity. And I'm not at all convinced that the mechanisms that we have set up to deal with this perceived threat to our climate from CO2 really are having anything of a positive impact on nations like that. Yet if you think of the resources, the amount of money being channeled and being spent, a fraction of that could make a huge difference for impoverished nations. So these are quite deep questions that we need to address. There are several texts here about our responsibility to love our neighbour and to act righteously and justly. Time is run out, so I leave you with the question that we started: is environmentalism a religion? I think that's a matter for you to decide rather than for me to force upon you. I hope that what we've been able to do is just expose some of the issues, the scientific issues, the questions, the philosophical issues of how opinion and post-normal science impacts upon science, and how melded together has very significant political ramifications in terms of climate change policy, which, whether we like it or not, impacts all of us wherever we live. So with that, I'll conclude. Anybody like to comment or have any questions?
Astrophysics point of view, there is this, let's say, few hypotheses that the sun and the activity of sun is actually making the increase of the temperature, and the temperature increasing just release more CO2 from the ocean. And this is probably something which one need to... Actually, what you have also stressed, that that this temperature and CO2 is somehow... there's a mix of the cause and effect. In a sense, I would say that the temperature probably is a cause and the CO2 is effect of the... Which was shown.
Yes, that's right.
I agree with you. The only problem which I have a problem, it is simply that I would stress more of the stewardship of us toward the earth, and I would put more in your theology. I would say I would put this dominion and what you call the dominion a bit in forward, because we are somehow still responsible for what is going on. And if we could do something, we should do somehow.
Yes, thanks for that comment. I think that is very important. I guess time ran out. This was a subject that I devoted, I think, two parts to the book that I wrote on this, which dealt much more with the stewardship. I think it's a difficult issue. The issue is what actually as Christians we can do when all of the prevailing policy is towards carbon emissions. I'd much rather see us deal with the impacts of climate rather than to actually put money into a rather false trading mechanism called carbon trading, which has a minuscule impact really on developing nations. I guess perhaps your point would be that in dealing more with the stewardship, we should be looking at other areas of the environment. It is the case that we do pollute, our world and our environment. And I've chosen to sort of focus on one topic, climate change, to deal with the issue is environmentalism a religion. But there are other aspects of the environment that, you're right, we should be good stewards of, and we need to think about what that actually means. Somebody else have a comment or question?
It's great that you were essentially correcting, in my view, you were correcting an error of being far too much the other way. So you were kind of emphasizing the difficulties with this view. I would also like to say that there's a parallel with the question of the origins in the universe, where if you think the biblical worldview is that God created and we are accountable to him and he will one day wind up the universe, and when people reject that biblical framework, they have to provide a substitute, because God, the God in whom they don't believe, has made their brain in a certain way where they have to have a framework of origins and ultimates. In my view, atheistic Darwinism is the substitute for creation and is also, to an extent, a religion. And this is the substitute for apocalypse. You know, we're going to fry. Yeah. And there's also a religious aspect about the middle bit, that apart from origins and conclusion, that if you don't go along with this stuff, there's a substitute ethics. You're a bad person. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a religion, yes, in the apocalypse view, but also in the origin view, and also in the substitute ethics, that if you don't buy this whole package, you're a bad person. Yeah. So I just kind of wanted to put that in that context. So I hope that was helpful.
Very, very helpful addition. Any other questions or comments? There's one over here.
I was amazed about the data you have shown. We have similar situations in medicine today with regenerative medicine, when you see that it's tooth and nail fighting between the scientists of who gets the most money from the government to do research. To me, it's not so much a question of religion, but it's two questions. One, of bad science, which if the data is so inconclusive, how can you conclude those things? And secondly, I think the politicians are so happy because here they have the most marvelous new idea for taxes.
That's right.
And then the trade is just a marketing exercise to sell you, to say, oh, we're going to collect all these taxes, and then we're going to do something good with it.
Yeah.
So, you know, an excellent marketing reminds me of the absolution of the Catholic Church when they invented marketing to say, we know that you're sinful, and this amount of money will get rid of your sins. But to me, it's absolutely amazing that in Europe, a continent that is so heavily taxed, that they found yet another brilliant idea on how to make money in the government. It's
Thank you for that. Any other comments?
That was good.
I do wonder whether that view has been rather cynical. I'm not sure that they're using it solely to raise taxes. I believe that some of the politicians, genuinely believe. I did a study of William Wilberforce. And it's interesting. I found that the arguments that people made against banning the slave trade are very similar to the arguments that people are making today about against taking climate change seriously. I've got if you want to have a look, there's a website, a web page. I made a table of the discussion. I'll give it to those who ask me.
But surely the data were on Wilberforce's side in that case. I don't know if there's a parallel, because although the way people make the case may be similar, the data in Wilberforce's case was overwhelmingly with him, that slavery was damaging, that it was incontrovertible, but in this case, is it not so?
I would not have thought so. They didn't have the same kind of scientific approach and so on at the time. But for example, one of the arguments was that it'll damage the economy, and they could have plenty of data to say how much of the economy depends on cheap sugar and so on, and that sort of thing.
Well, my point was that in the actual issue, the slavery or the appallingness of slavery was well documented, whereas here, the alleged data to justify the case is not so sound as people say it is. That's my point.
I have a question, Gregory. You said that from your experience in Kenya, you see that some of the things that are being suggested or done about the CO2 impact, which people say has on the climate, has damaging or not really helpful effects on the difficult situation, for example, energy-wise, of people in poor countries. Could you elaborate on this a little bit, exemplify what you were saying?
Yeah, I think one of the key things that a developing country needs, and take Kenya as an example, is access to cheap energy. Most people in rural areas, or many people in rural areas, don't have electricity. They have to cook with wood. They often cook inside, and the actual particle pollution, if you like, from doing that has a deleterious effect on children. So there are many ways in which you can see if what you could do was to at least provide a cheap source of electricity, there would be many health improvements, probably economic improvements as well. But electricity isn't cheap, and it's not available to a large percentage of the population. I think the point I'm trying to make with the CDM, for example, is that you think, well, maybe that's a nice idea, so the rich countries can actually now put in wind farms or solar panels and so on, and that will solve the problem. The sorts of projects, as I illustrated, that are being carried out, only a fraction of them are actually generating clean energy by means of wind, for example, or solar panels. That technology is relatively expensive, so the sorts of projects that you see are fairly small scale, and you'll sometimes see examples quoted of a solar panel on a medical unit, and well, that doesn't really solve the problem, because what they need is several solar panels, and the cost of solar panels is quite significant. And if you just think, even in the West, the cost of implementing wind turbine energy or solar panels or other alternatives is quite high. And here's, I suppose, where the danger of cynicism creeping in is, that why is it that that in the West probably people would prefer to go down the route of either buying more credits or buying credits through the CDM. It's because actually it's very costly to change the means by which we in the West generate electricity. So in effect what I think we're doing is denying developing countries, my wife puts it this way, we're denying them their industrial revolution. Actually, the biggest generator probably of carbon dioxide, I slipped over that slide, is China. We're effectively in the West saying we want to deny them their industrial revolution. So it's a huge challenge, and I think that if we were really serious about dealing with poverty, we'd actually be putting the trillions into supplying cheap energy for developing countries, but we don't. It's all biased in favour of the West through the carbon trading program. Peter, does that sort of help to illustrate?
The most appealing spiritual point you have made, which I did not consider so far. I considered all the other. The universe was made by God. We are stewards. But you said, love your neighbour and act justly. I think that is something that is definitely something I will consider. I think all of us Christians, or even all men, should consider, because everything that God has given us, he has given us to invest. So that would address Kenya, that would address, even any other neighbor. as long as we just do it for ourselves and keep it to ourselves, you know, it's going to be very hard to do what you said, you know, to let others have their industrial revolution or have cheap energy or those kinds of things.
I think, too, the challenge for us as Christians, as in so many other areas of medical ethics or whatever else it might be that impacts us as Christians, we are going countercultural. If you accept the hypothesis that environmentalism, as I've described it, is a worldview, and that some of the conclusions are erroneous, but there are things that we need to do, then we are swimming against the tide, not just in our own countries, but almost globally. And I think it's a huge challenge for us as Christians to act justly, to act rightly, but where our conclusions may differ from the popular view, if you like, about climate change and what we actually need to do about it. Huge challenge for us. And on that, I think we'll close.